Right now, there are nearly 2,000 companies around the world worth a combined $7 trillion. And you are legally forbidden from investing in almost all of them.
Yeah, which is kind of wild to think about. And it's not like these are secret government projects either. I mean, these are the companies building the software you use every single day.
Right. Or the breakthrough medical research your family might rely on, or even just the apps sitting on your phone right now, they are completely off limits to the public stock market. But they represent the absolute vanguard of the global innovation economy. So, welcome to today's deep dive. We're unpacking the hidden multi-trillion dollar engines of modern wealth, which are private equity and venture capital.
And we really wanted to dive into this because that $7 trillion wall is, it's actually starting to crack. Because the conventional wisdom is always that if you don't work on Wall Street or, you know, live in Silicon Valley, the private markets just don't affect you.
Which is just completely false.
Exactly. The reality is your own money is likely tied up in this exact ecosystem right now. Like if you have a pension fund or if your employer offers a 401k, a really significant portion of your retirement is already riding on the success of these massive private funds.
Which means we all really need to understand how the machine actually works, right? And just to give you a sense of the sheer scale we are talking about today in 2026, the global private equity market is valued at roughly $7.2 trillion.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's projected to hit nearly $21.7 trillion by 2035. Meanwhile, venture capital assets under management have surged to nearly $3.5 trillion globally. So this isn't just a niche corner of finance anymore, it's the main event.
Right, it's the whole show. And our mission today is to kind of break down the architecture of this asset class. We're going to look at how this ecosystem was originally built and then explore why the traditional model is currently facing this massive, unprecedented liquidity squeeze.
Yeah, the gears are definitely grinding right now.
They really are. And finally, we'll look at how artificial intelligence and these new secondary markets are just completely rewriting the rules of the game.
Yeah.
But, you know, to understand why the system is under so much stress, we have to start with the foundational mechanics. So private equity and venture capital both rely on a very specific two-sided partnership structure.
Right, so you have the limited partners or LPs and the general partners or GPs. The LPs are basically the entities supplying the capital. We are talking about major institutional allocators here, so public pension funds, university endowments, sovereign wealth
The
funds.
heavy hitters.
Exactly. They have billions to invest, but they delegate all the day-to-day decisions. The GPs are the actual investment professionals who take that money, go out into the market, find the deals, manage the companies, and eventually sell them.
Yeah, and the strategies those GPs use kind of fall into two broad buckets. Let's look at venture capital first.
Okay, let's unpack this because I think a real estate analogy works perfectly here to visualize the difference in these two strategies. Venture capital is basically like buying an empty plot of dirt in like an unproven neighborhood and planting a single seed.
Felt like that.
Yeah, so you're funding a two-person startup with just an idea and a pitch deck. You are hoping that seed grows into a massive 100-story skyscraper. And the mechanics here rely heavily on the power law. You go into this knowing that maybe 75% of the startups in your portfolio are going to fail completely.
The dirt just stays dirt.
Exactly, the dirt stays dirt. But if just one of those seeds becomes the next Google or Meta, it returns like 10,000 times your initial investment, which easily pays for all the failures.
Right. Now, traditional private equity, specifically what we call leveraged buyouts, operates on a completely different risk profile.
Yeah.
So, keeping with your real estate analogy, this is like buying a mature, slightly run-down Class B apartment building.
Yeah.
But you don't buy it with just the cash in your pocket. You take out a massive commercial mortgage, what finance professionals call debt gearing, to actually purchase the building.
Yeah.
Then you roll up your sleeves, you renovate the kitchens, upgrade the plumbing, raise the rent to increase the cash flow, and eventually you sell that modernized building to a larger buyer for a huge profit.
And you pay off the debt along the way.
Exactly.
Which is crazy because, like, in the 1980s and early 2000s, GPs could generate massive returns almost entirely through that mortgage aspect. It was just pure financial engineering. Interest rates were incredibly low, meaning debt was cheap.
Right, basically free money.
Yeah, so you could borrow heavily, buy a company, and let the cheap leverage amplify your returns without actually changing much about the business itself.
But that era is definitively over. I mean, we're living in a much higher interest rate environment today, making that old playbook totally obsolete. GPs can no longer rely on cheap debt to artificially inflate returns. So the entire industry has been forced to shift toward operational engineering.
Meaning they actually have to, you know, build better, more efficient businesses.
Yeah, they actually have to do the work now. And what's fascinating here is one of the primary mechanisms they use now is the buy and build campaign. So a private equity firm will acquire a strong, high-quality platform company in a highly fragmented industry. So let's say regional dental clinics or HVAC repair services.
Oh, well, like mom and pop shops.
Exactly. Then they actively buy up smaller local competitors and just bolt them onto the main platform.
Mm.
It's this deliberate strategy to create economies of scale. Because by combining five small companies into one regional powerhouse, you can cut redundant costs like having one HR department instead of five and drive real organic growth.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And firms now employ dedicated operating teams, like former CEOs and supply chain experts, just to execute this consolidation.
See, I understand the strategy, but looking at the sources, the cost to execute this seems incredibly steep for the LPs who are putting up all the cash. Let's talk about the price of admission. The industry runs on something traditionally known as the 2-in-20 fee structure.
Ah, yes, the famous 2-in-20.
Right. So first, the GPs charge a 2% management fee on the committed capital every single year. This funds the due diligence, pays the salaries of those operating teams you mentioned, and basically just keeps the firm running. Then the 20 refers to a 20% carried interest, or carry. That is the GP's cut of the actual profits generated when a company is finally sold.
So put yourself in the shoes of an LP managing a teacher's pension fund, right? You commit your capital to a private equity fund, and the GP starts charging you that 2% fee immediately. But the catch is, they haven't actually bought any companies yet.
Wait, really? So the capital is just sitting there?
Just sitting there, being drawn down by fees. Mm-hmm. And even when they do buy a company, it takes years to execute a buy and build strategy.
Wait, so if I'm an LP, for the first few years of this partnership, I'm just straight up losing money.
This is a recognized structural reality of the asset class. It's known as the J curve. If you plot a fund's returns on a graph over time, early in the fund's life, the line dips deep into negative territory. Management fees are draining capital, and the early investments just haven't had time to mature or appreciate in value.
So the line literally traces the shape of a J.
Exactly. It's only in the later years, usually years 5 through 10, as companies are optimized and sold, that the returns finally climb upward into profitability.
But when those companies are finally sold and the profits materialize, the way that money gets divided up is fascinating. It's dictated by a mechanism called the distribution waterfall.
Right.
Let's use a champagne tower metaphor. Imagine a tower of glasses. Mm. In what is called a European waterfall, the LP investors are the glasses at the very bottom tier, and the GP is the single glass at the very top. And the rule is the bottom tier has to be filled to the absolute brim before a single drop of profit flows upward.
So the LPs get whole first.
Exactly. The LPs must receive back 100% of their initial capital for the entire fund, plus a guaranteed preferred return, usually a hurdle rate around 7 or 8% before the GP sees a dime of that 20% carried interest.
Right. But the alternative is the American waterfall, which calculates profits on a deal-by-deal basis. So if the GP buys 10 companies and successfully sells the very first one for a massive profit, they immediately take their 20% cut of that specific deal.
Wow.
Yeah, that champagne pops and a top glass gets a sip immediately, regardless of the fact that the other 9 companies in the portfolio might currently be losing money.
Which seems wildly risky for the LPs, because what happens if those other 9 companies eventually go bankrupt? The GP already walked away with a massive payout from the first deal, and the overall fund is in the red.
And that specific risk is exactly why American waterfalls legally require strict clawback provisions. At the end of the fund's 10-year life cycle, an audit is conducted. If the math shows the GP took more than their overall 20% share of the aggregate profits because of those early wins, they are legally obligated to return the excess cash back to the LPs.
So this entire structure, the 2-in-20 fees, the champagne tower waterfall, climbing out of the J curve, it all relies on one crucial mechanism, which is that the right side of that J actually has to go up.
Right. It relies on the market actually functioning.
Exactly. Companies getting sold or going public and cash flowing back to the investors. But what happens when the pipeline clogs?
Well, then we arrive at the reality of 2026. The machine has basically stalled, resulting in this massive, unprecedented liquidity squeeze.
So let's look at the underlying mechanics of why the pipeline clogged. Historically, the standard holding period for one of these private companies was 3 to 7 years. The GP buys it, scales it, and exits, usually by taking the company public through an IPO. But look at the public markets. In the 1990s, we saw 1,598 U.S. tech companies go public.
And in the 2020s?
Just 227.
Which is a staggering drop. And a major catalyst for that drop was regulatory shifts. So in the early 2000s, legislation like the Sarbanes-Oxley Act introduced rigorous new accounting and reporting rules. Going public suddenly required an army of auditors and compliance officers, which made it incredibly expensive.
Oh, I see.
And simultaneously, over the last decade, central banks pushed interest rates to near zero. This flooded the private markets with institutional capital searching for higher yields. Founders suddenly realized they could raise hundreds of millions of dollars privately without having to deal with the expense of quarterly earnings calls or public market scrutiny.
Right. So because they could stay private longer, the timeline just completely broke. The average time it takes for a venture-backed company to IPO has stretched to 12 years now.
12 years.
Yeah. And as a result of this massive delay, we now have roughly 1,920 private and held unicorns sitting out there globally. And for context, a unicorn is a startup with a post-money valuation of over $1 billion. Post-money valuation just means what the company is theoretically worth immediately after it receives its latest private funding check.
And combined, those 1,920 companies represent more than $7.3 trillion in valuation. Within the VC funds themselves, there is an estimated $3 trillion in unrealized value just trapped on balance sheets.
$3 trillion. I mean, that is an almost unfathomable amount of wealth just sitting in regulatory limbo. And you can see this with companies everyone knows. SpaceX raised its early venture capital all the way back in 2005. It is only now looking at an IPO in 2026, more than two decades later. Stripe was founded in 2010 and is still a private company. If I am an LP relying on cash distributions to pay out real retirement checks to real teachers this year, paper valuations don't help me.
They absolutely don't. And this brings us to a critical shift in how the industry measures success. For years, GPs marketed themselves using a metric called IRR, or internal rate of return.
Right. I always think of IRR like a hypothetical high score on a video game. It measures the paper markups of a company's value based on its latest funding round, but it isn't realized wealth. LPs are realizing they can't pay teacher pensions with video game high scores.
Exactly. So the focus has violently shifted to a metric called DPI, which is distributions to paid-in capital. DPI is the cold, hard cash actually returned to the LP's wallet. And the current DPI data reveals the real depth of this distribution drought. Historically, funds that were 5 to 10 years old had returned about 20% of their value to investors. By the end of 2025, that average plummeted to 12%. Yeah, and furthermore, three quarters of the funds that launched in 2021 had returned less than a quarter of their investors' money by their fourth anniversary.
So LPs are just starting for cash. Because they aren't getting distributions, they don't have the capital to reinvest into new venture funds, which in turn starves the next generation of early stage startups.
It's a vicious cycle.
It really is.
Yeah.
The traditional exit pipes IPOs or selling to large corporations are blocked. So the industry had to invent a release valve to keep the ecosystem alive and extract some of that trapped cash.
And that release valve is the secondary market. Traditionally, if you invested in a private company, your money was locked up until an IPO or an acquisition. The secondary market allows existing investors, say, an early VC fund needing to return cash to LPs, or maybe early startup employees wanting to buy a house to sell their private stakes to other private buyers.
Okay, so they don't have to wait for the IPO.
Right. It used to be this kind of desperate niche maneuver. But today, it is essential financial infrastructure. In 2025, secondary transactions hit $106.3 billion, making up nearly a third of all VC-backed exits.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. It's essentially a giant game of musical chairs. The music has paused, the IPO door is locked, but you are allowed to sell your specific chair to someone else in the room who wants to sit down. But I'm guessing this only works for the famous companies, right?
Basically.
Yeah, like if I want to sell my shares in OpenAI, buyers are probably lining up around the block. But if I work at an unknown mid-tier startup that isn't on the cover of magazines, no one wants to buy my shares because they can't see the quarterly earnings. It's an information black hole.
Yes. The lack of transparency creates massive friction. The current secondary system is highly bifurcated. So the data shows that the top 20 most actively traded private companies account for an astonishing 86.4% of all secondary transaction volume.
Wow, just 20 companies.
Just 20. For the long tail of startups, the thousands of other companies, the secondary market is effectively closed. due to transaction costs and information asymmetry. Every secondary sale requires complex legal reviews, multi-party consent from the company's board, deep due diligence. I mean, it's just cost prohibitive for smaller transactions.
So if only 20 companies can effectively use the escape valve, the pressure is still going to blow up the engine eventually. How's the financial engineering adapting to fix this?
So we're seeing three major innovations. First, GPs are launching what they call continuation funds, where they basically orchestrate a sale of an asset from their own older fund to a brand new fund that they also manage, essentially manufacturing an exit to give old LPs a chance to cash out.
That feels a little like moving money from your left pocket to your right pocket, but okay.
It does, but it generates liquidity. Second, we are seeing a significant push toward tokenization on blockchains.
Let's define tokenization for a second. This is basically taking one incredibly expensive, illiquid share of a private company and using blockchain technology to mathematically split it into thousands of digital fractional pieces. So instead of needing $10 million to buy a block of private shares, a smaller investor can buy a $100 digital fraction of that exact same asset.
Exactly. By fractionalizing the asset, you drastically lower the transaction costs and the barriers to entry, which leads directly to the third innovation. The rise of new ETFs and retail platforms designed specifically to aggregate everyday retail capital and funnel it into these private secondary stakes.
Because liquidity is so scarce right now, investors are becoming incredibly picky about where they actually deploy fresh capital. They're retreating from emerging risky markets and kind of doubling down on safe, proven geographic hubs. And this dynamic brings us to a massive global scaling gap. Startups might be founded in garages all over the world, but actually scaling them up into global champions is geographically rigged.
It really is. And the concentration of wealth highlights this disparity perfectly. The U.S. and China absolutely dominate the scaling game. Together, they account for roughly 75% of all unicorns globally. But when you look at enterprise value, the actual dollar worth of those companies, the concentration is even more extreme. The U.S. and China hold a massive 82% of total unicorn value.
And compare that to Europe. Europe produces about 13.5% of the world's unicorns, but they only hold 8% of the global value. So they're incubating these brilliant early stage companies, but they consistently struggle to scale them to the highest valuation tiers.
And the primary mechanism holding Europe back is this kind of invisible scaling tax driven by fragmented regulations. Think about it. Scaling a software company across 50 unified U.S. states requires compliance with one overarching federal framework.
Right. It's pretty seamless.
Exactly. Scaling that same company across Europe requires navigating 27 different national labor laws, varying tax codes, and distinct data privacy regulations. It's a nightmare.
But population size and geography aren't necessarily destiny, right? If you measure unicorns per capita, Singapore actually leads the world with 6.8 unicorns per million people. It proves that deliberate government policy, strategic deployment of sovereign capital, and smart regulatory innovation can create an ecosystem that punches far above its weight class.
Absolutely. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, we cannot examine the geography or the mechanics of private markets in 2026 without analyzing the impact of artificial intelligence. I mean, AI is fundamentally rewriting the unit economics of venture capital.
Oh, let's break down how AI changes those unit economics. Because on one hand, you have AI native software startups that are reaching massive revenue milestones with incredibly lean teams. Because AI handles the coding, the customer service, the initial sales outreach, a founder doesn't need to hire 500 engineers to scale a product anymore. They can do it with 50.
Right.
Which theoretically means they need way less venture capital to get off the ground.
Right, on the software side. But on the other hand, the infrastructure required to actually train and run those foundational AI models, the sheer compute power, the massive data centers, the energy grid, upgrades, all of that demands capital on an industrial scale that traditional VC funds were just never designed to provide.
Because traditional venture funds are capped.
Exactly. When an AI infrastructure company needs a $100 billion funding round just to secure semiconductor chips, the venture ecosystem has to evolve.
And we saw this. The latest OpenAI round was four times larger than the biggest IPO in history, which was Saudi Aramco. To facilitate rounds that massive, we are seeing the rise of crossover investors. So these are massive mutual funds, public market asset managers, and sovereign wealth funds dipping down into the private markets. Because AI requires capital pools that simply don't exist in traditional Sand Hill Road venture firms.
And AI isn't just changing what GPs invest in, it's revolutionizing how they operate internally too. So GPs are deploying bespoke AI models to automate their own due diligence processes.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, instead of a team of junior analysts spending 4 weeks reading through a target company's documents, an AI system can scan thousands of pages of tax disclosures, supply chain contracts, and regulatory filings in literally minutes.
Right, and it identifies hidden legal liabilities or accounting anomalies before a deal even closes, which drastically reduces diligence costs and completely changes the speed at which capital can be deployed.
Exactly. So if we synthesize everything we've unpacked today, a really clear narrative emerges. Private capital built the modern technology sector, but the historical model of quick 3 to 7 year exits through an IPO is fundamentally broken right now.
Yeah, companies are staying private for well over a decade, trapping trillions of dollars. This massive liquidity squeeze has basically forced the industry to abandon pure financial engineering with cheap debt in favor of gritty, complex operational engineering.
And because the IPO window is largely closed, the industry has had to engineer these massive secondary markets just to keep capital recycling through the system.
Which connects directly back to you, the listener. Because as traditional institutional money gets tapped out, the industry is aggressively looking for fresh capital. Through regulatory changes, tokenization, expanded 401k options, and these new retail platforms, this formerly exclusive private market is actively opening its doors to everyday people.
Which leaves us with a really critical financial reality to mull over. Because for decades, the high risks of private equity, you know, the total illiquidity, the subjective paper valuations, and blind pool investing, where you hand a GP your money without knowing exactly which companies are going to buy, all of that was restricted to giant institutions. Pension funds and university endowments could afford to take a hit if a specific fund failed. But as the industry turns to retail investors to help solve its massive liquidity drought, we have to ask a really difficult question.
Okay.
Are everyday investors being invited to the private market party just in time to foot the bill for the hangover?
Wow. That is the trillion-dollar question, isn't it? The engine driving global innovation is undeniably powerful, but the gears are definitely grinding, and you need to understand the mechanics of the machine before you decide to take a seat. Thank you for joining us today on The Deep Dive. Keep questioning the forces shaping our world, and we will see you next time.